easily over $500,000 worth of drugs found so far, and the search is continuing.
Felony arrests as Unalaska police uncover a large drug operation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Greenpeace protest of seismic tests in the Arctic.
Seismic surveys will go on in certain parts of the Russian license areas this year and next year.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project.
Unalaska police may have reached a turning point in a long investigation into drug sales. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, two people are in custody after a stockpile was discovered at the home and business they both share.
Unalaska's police chief, Jamie Sunderland, says he can't remember a bigger bust.
Easily over $500,000 worth of drugs found so far, and the search is continuing.
It's turned up staggering quantities of methamphetamine and cocaine, more than 2 pounds each. Large amounts of marijuana and two kinds of heroin have also been recovered.
There's certainly more evidence out there and clues to be found, but we feel that we have, found a major player in this enterprise here.
Tu McConnell and Tam Nguyen are both 45 years old. Their current relationship is unclear, but they have raised a family together, and they've definitely gone into business in Unalaska, opening a cab company, a tanning salon, and a variety store called Dutch Harbor Asia. Police say that store is where Tam Nguyen was on May 24th when he allegedly sold 2 packets of heroin. The order for those drugs came from a criminal informant who agreed to buy heroin from his sources in the community to try and get leniency on his own charges. Officers arrested Nguyen shortly after that alleged drug deal. Along with the regular inventory, snacks, jewelry, and movies, police say they found digital scales and a loaded semi-automatic handgun. They also say there were 55 individually wrapped packets of heroin, cocaine, and meth. Based on that, officers got warrants to search Nguyen and McConnell's house, and arrest warrants to put them in jail. Now, the pair is facing multiple felony charges for allegedly possessing drugs with the intent to distribute them in the community. Illegal drug sales are always a target for police action, but Unalaska's been cracking down since last fall. That's when police orchestrated the first of 2 big sweeps, arresting up to 9 people at once. At least 24 have been taken into custody and charged since then. Sunderland, the police chief, says officers have been getting tips about the operators of Dutch Harbor Asia in the process. But to Del Huber, they were model tenants. Huber's the property manager at the strip mall where Dutch Harbor Asia is located.
It was a smooth relationship. You know, their business was pretty much smooth. We never had no problems with anything.
Huber says he did some renovations in the building and helped fix up the Dutch Harbor Asia storefront. The operators seemed happy, he says. They even agreed to sign a longer lease. But lately, the couple had been trying to get out of the business. Tu McConnell posted it for sale on a Facebook message board in January, even cutting the price to attract a buyer. Earlier this month, she listed her house for sale. Huber, the property manager, says he doesn't know what's going to happen now that the pair is in jail.
As of right now, it's totally up in the air, and all we can do is just take care of the rest of the tenants in the mall and make sure everything's up kept, and also make sure that Dutch Harbor Asia, it stays secured.
That means making sure customers respect the sign in the window that says, for now, the business is closed. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
A Greenpeace protest against Statoil ended a few hours ago in the Barents Sea. The Norwegian Coast Guard boarded a ship that was blocking access to a drill site at what could be the northernmost Arctic oil well. The Esperanza is currently being towed away by the Coast Guard, which Greenpeace says in a press release violates international maritime law. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
On board the ship, Soon Schiller, a campaigner with Greenpeace, says the actions are part of increasing efforts against Arctic drilling.
We are escalating our actions against Arctic drilling. I mean, the oil industry are escalating their activities in the far north, and so are we.
Schiller was in Point Hope 2 years ago with Greenpeace, protesting Dutch Royal Shell's offshore exploration in the Chukchi Sea. And while the company announced earlier this year they won't be resuming work in Chukchi waters this season, there's an American company that will, but on the Russian side.
Seismic surveys will go on in certain parts of the Russian license areas this year and next year, just like we did in the past 2 years in the Kara Sea.
That's Patrick McGeehan, spokesman for ExxonMobil, which is partnering with Russian energy company Rosneft on several projects, including a seismic survey in the Chukchi Basin, above the Chukotka Peninsula and west of the Bering Strait. Seismic surveys are a first step in assessing potential undersea oil reserves and use blasts of air to map the seafloor. ExxonMobil is handling technical aspects of the project, while Rosneft handles local affairs. McGeehan says both companies have protocols in place to make sure national and international rules are followed.
Just like in the United States, in Russia, the oil companies are required to have public consultation meetings, and Rosneft does that with their local communities where they talk about the activities that's going to take place.
But several groups in the Chukotka region criticize Rosneft's consultation process. They've filed a claim with the public prosecutor's office alleging that ecological assessments are based on different habitat and insufficiently consider social and environmental impacts on marine mammals near Chukotka. Alexei Zemenko, director of the Center for Wild Nature Preservation, wrote in January that by ignoring input from local populations, Rosneft is violating current legislation in Russia. There's also disagreement over the impact to marine mammals from seismic testing, a debate taking place in Alaska, too. Sue Binet is with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM, which handles oil and gas permitting in U.S. federal waters. She says American companies like ExxonMobil are careful when it comes to regulations around monitoring marine mammals.
During activities, there will be continual monitoring from the agencies, in BOEM in particular, based on reports from observers that will be in all ships, and also from weekly reports on operations.
The monitoring program puts trained observers on survey boats to spot whales, walruses, and other marine mammals and instruct the crew to reduce or cease seismic operations until the animals have passed. McGeehan says Exxon takes the measures seriously.
Although I got to tell you, we've been doing this for many decades in the water, and there's never been a documented case, a proven case of a marine mammal being injured by seismic testing.
But many say the monitoring program doesn't work. In December, a Russian walrus biologist, Anatoly Kochnev, wrote that Rosneft has offered insufficient evidence seismic blasts won't disrupt the massive walrus pods and haulouts that Chukotkan hunters rely on. In Alaska, the North Slope Borough banned seismic and industrial noise during the fall bowhead hunt, citing scientific evidence backing up claims by whaling captains that, observed or not, underwater noise deflects whales. Back in the Barents, Schiller says regardless of proper conduct, development shouldn't go forward until there's an ability to clean up accidents if a well ever does go online.
There is no oil spill response plan when a major oil spill takes place that far north. You have to take in consideration the very long distance to any sort of usable infrastructure. The amount of ships that can respond to it is minimal. And when the oil gets mixed with the ice, it's just become an impossible job to do.
While activists protest Arctic drilling in the Barents, ExxonMobil and Rosneft are set to begin work this summer on another potential Arctic oil deposit, once the last of the Chukchi sea ice moves out. For KNOM in Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering a tenacious Juno reporter.
The fact is that he came closer to really doing the job that we all ought to be doing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Veteran Alaska journalist Bob Tkach has died. He was 61. With his gravelly voice and dogged interviewing style, Tkach was a fixture in the state capitol press corps for more than 20 years. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Bob Tkach peppered his share of Alaska politicians with a seemingly endless line of questions. Here he is grilling Governor Sean Parnell at a press conference in March after Parnell criticized an Environmental Protection Agency law enforcement raid of interior mining camps.
The law that says you can shoot anybody that's threatening you if you're in a legal place among miners who commonly carry guns has no impact here?
There's no facts right now that says that a federal officer or a miner pointed a gun at anybody, so we're not talking about that issue right now. Anybody else on a different topic?
Tkach also had his lighthearted moments, such as this 2004 exchange with then-Governor Frank Murkowski.
Look, why didn't he bring it up during the regular session when one senator brought up a vote on income tax, brought up a vote on sales tax?
I cannot imagine he wants me to speak for him.
Former administration commissioner Becky Holtberg was Murkowski's press secretary at the time.
Bob really liked to get under people's skin if he could, and he'd kind of know when he did, and he'd keep poking, keep going.
Holtberg says she always respected the job Tkach was trying to do. She doesn't remember the issue, but says there was one exchange in particular where she tried to step in to prevent the governor from saying something he might regret.
Ultimately, I was physically trying to maneuver my body between the governor and the podium to try to get the governor out of the room, because Bob had really accomplished what he wanted to accomplish, which was getting the governor riled up. And when people are upset, they tend to be very quotable and not always in a good way.
Former APRN Juneau correspondent Dave Donaldson began covering the Alaska legislature about the same time as Tkach. They worked near each other in the Capitol press room for 21 years. Though they were friends, Donaldson says even fellow reporters sometimes got fed up with Tkach's aggressive style.
Bob would not let go, and he would go forever. And, yeah, it did get a little annoying every once in a while, but the fact is that he came closer to really doing the job that we all ought to be doing than a lot of people who say, okay, thank you, and hang up.
In September 1991, Tkach was beaten and stabbed in an apparent mugging in Juneau. A New York Times story about the incident is still one of the first search results when you Google his name. Donaldson remembers visiting him in the hospital.
He couldn't talk, so he was trying to draw notes, and he finally got it across to me that the reason I was there was to call his publisher and say he'd be late for deadline.
Tkach worked or freelanced for several Alaska media outlets, including KTOO. In recent years, he wrote for Alaska Legislative Digest and the Alaska Journal of Commerce. His stories also appeared in national and international publications. In 1994, he started his own subscription news service, Laws for the Sea, about the commercial fishing and seafood industry. He lived alone on his boat in Aurora Harbor and often spent his free time at Augustus Brown Swimming Pool. Juneau police say they responded to a report of a death at Tkach's downtown office Tuesday and found his body. The death is not considered suspicious. His body has been taken to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage for an autopsy. Tkach was originally from Ohio, where friends say he still has family. Services are pending. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The Bethel test fishery put nets in the water 5 days early this year. With no salmon fishing happening in the early season, the test data will be central to understanding the strength of the king run and helping managers decide when to open up for other species. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
In its 30 years of operations, the Bethel test fishery has begun drifting June 1st. This year, crews started May 27th. Kevin Schaberg is a research biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Breakup was pretty early this year, and reports from around the state and on the Kuskokwim was that fish were coming in a little bit early here and there.
Crews have caught both king and sockeye salmon in the first couple days of operations. And given this year's severe king salmon restrictions, Shaberg is expecting many more king salmon to come through the test waters relative to typical years when people have been fishing below Bethel.
This year, everybody knows, is a very different year. This is something that I don't know if we've ever seen on the Kuskokwim River as far as lack of harvest at this time of the year. So interpretation of the Bethel test fishery is going to take a little bit longer to get a really solid signal on whether we think the run's doing well or very poor.
On Thursday morning, representatives from Bethel's tribe ONC picked up a small tote box of test fishery king salmon bound for elders' meals at Bethel's Senior Center. Other research initiatives this summer include having lower river fishermen collecting scales to estimate age and sex composition, and in early July, a Yukon River sonar crew will come to evaluate sites for a possible sonar project. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Rain and cooler conditions have given firefighters a chance to strengthen their effort and get a step ahead in their battle with the Funny River fire on the Kenai. Officials are always trying to plan a few days in advance, but now they're also looking ahead to the next few months and long-term management of the fire and its effects. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
Over the next few days, crews will continue to focus their efforts on the parts of the fire that could threaten inhabited areas or property.
We'll be concentrating really heavily on that northeast corner that's across the Kenai River, the section between the Kenai River and the Kylie River, and then down to the fuel break.
That's Incident Commander Rob Allen. He says there are also a few areas of concern within the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge.
And then on the southwest side of the fire, that little section between Star Lake and Testamina Lake is where we're going to be focusing most of our concentration on cleaning that up, mopping that up, getting the IR flight out to look for hot spots so that we can feel really confident and tell Division of Forestry and the Fish and Wildlife that it's secure from Skelak Lake all the way around the western perimeter to Testamina Lake.
However, Allen says that there will likely be fire activity deeper in the refuge for quite some time. Refuge manager Andy Loringer says fire is a natural part of the ecosystem, but this fire did not start naturally from a lightning strike, for example, so the refuge is looking into the effects of such a large off-season burn.
You know, from the type of things that we think about normally relative to the role of fire, it's a little early to tell. You know, this is a very early season fire that really typically wouldn't be replicated in terms of a natural fire on the refuge. So we are going to evaluate that and do some monitoring and try to keep track of, you know, what's happening as the vegetation and et cetera recovers from the fire.
There will be both short-term and long-term effects of this fire. It's impossible to know what all of those will be, but this fire has changed the face of the Central Kenai Peninsula for years to come. Reporting from Soldotna, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Aleknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, a musical celebration. Alaskans have had some big anniversaries this year, the 64 earthquake and the Exxon Valdez oil spill among them. Acoustic musicians celebrated their own anniversary last month in Juneau, the Alaska Folk Festival's 40th. The week of concerts attract hundreds of singers, pickers, strummers, and thousands of audience members from around the state and the nation. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has attended 36 of the 40 events. He took a walk down memory lane with some Folkfest old-timers and filed this report.
I was living in the shade, I had it made, till the boss said, hey, I got news for you, it's time for me to downsize you.
That drawl, those droll lyrics, and the guitar licks have all been part of the Alaska Folk Festival since it began in 1975. They belong to Pat Henry, one of two and only two people who've performed at all 40 events. Sharing the stage is Bob Banghart, the only other person who's played every single festival.
Now I'm standing at the back of the welfare line, seeing all my friends there all the time.
I catch up with Henry as he heads outside the concert hall for a smoke on this rainy night. So what's it like to walk in and realize it's the 40th year and you've been here for every one?
I think it's pretty amazing that I'm here. I never expected to live this long. It's all gravy.
The folk festival began in the main gallery of the Alaska State Museum.
Oh my gosh, it was, of course, a lot smaller.
Longtime festival volunteer Barbara Pavitt was there.
I don't remember exactly how many acts, but, you know, it was just one evening, probably a couple of hours, and maybe 100 people came.
The event quickly outgrew that space. Now, concerts, workshops, jam sessions, and dances are held in and around Juneau Centennial Hall Convention Center. Over the decades, Alaska's folk, bluegrass, jazz, and rock and roll musicians have made the festival part of their annual calendar. One is Greg McLaughlin, who plays the concertina in a Celtic dance band. His first time was about 35 years ago when he caught a ride down from Fairbanks. He says he didn't quite know what he was getting into.
And I saw a sign next to the poster at the Hungry Dog Cafe that said, if you want to go to the folk festival, the bus is leaving at midnight. And there were about 16 hippies that showed up, and we all piled onto this bus, and we came down to the Alaska Folk Festival. That was my first experience.
He liked what he heard a lot. He recently retired after many years as president of the festival's board. A lot of regulars started coming as teens or young adults. Others began as kids and never stopped.
Oh, when the saints go marching in. Oh, when the saints go marching.
Photographer Brian Wallace was more into Alice Cooper than Alice's Restaurant back at the beginning. But he happened into that first 1975 festival by accident, and he's been taking pictures and listening to music ever since.
So it's cool, you know, I mean, every year it kind of regenerates itself, kind of like the phoenix, you know, the old guard passes on, and, you know, we saw those two young kids up there, they couldn't be more than 10, 12, 13 years old, and, you know, they're going to be the old guard someday.
It was in the winter wind of 73. First time my pops completely froze on me.
Some of those kids are from Pat Henry's family. The concerts where they played are his favorite festival memories.
Well, I'm a proud daddy, you know. And a proud granddaddy.
So do you think you'll be here for the 50th?
I would like to think I'll be here. If I'm still going and can, I will.
If he is, you'll find him up on stage, leading a crowd of musicians in the traditional festival finale.
Irene, good night.
For AK, I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to Rampart in interior Alaska. The Koyukon Athabascan community is tiny, but working to attract new residents.
My name is Floyd Green. I'm the first chief and tribal administrator of Rampart, Alaska. It's a small community on the Yukon River on the south bank. We have beautiful summers and long, dark winters. Kings usually get here at the end of June, early July. And then the silver salmon usually get here in August, middle of August. We have a small store right now at the council office. Gas, diesel, bottled water. In 2005, the state started our road, the Rampart Road. And they put in two bridges, and then they stopped 17 miles out of the community. You can go in a car in early winter, late spring, when it's still frozen. There's 26 of us. We're working on getting people to move back by offering jobs and housing. There used to be like 70 people here, and then the school closed in 1999. And then our population went down to 8 until last year. I mean, we're like one big family. You know, we're smaller, so we all stick together, you know. Come together for birthdays and things like that. And every visitor that comes here really enjoys it. I mean, we're a friendly crowd, I guess.
Floyd Green is tribal administrator of Rampart, Alaska. He's just 21 years old. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ed Schoenfeld and Annie Feit. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Shady Grove Oliver in Soldotna. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.